This is the November 19 edition of the Closing Market Report, Sustainable Aviation Fuel. CoBank is one of the largest private providers of credit to the U.S. rural economy. Now, the bank delivers loans, leases, and other financial services to agribusinesses, rural infrastructure, and farm credit customers in all 50 states. It has a vested interest, therefore, in anything that might improve commodity prices. Jackie Fatka follows the biofuels industry for CoBank. Her expertise lies in ag policy, biofuels, trade, regulations, ag labor, climate smart agriculture, and farm management. Well, I spoke with her at the National Association of Farm Broadcasting Convention in Kansas City, and we took up sustainable aviation fuel, sometimes called SAF or SAF. I wanted to know why CoBank, a lending institution, found SAF, a biofuel that can be made from either corn or soybean, so intriguing.
I mean, historically, CoBank has been a major partner as we've built out the ethanol industry over the years. Obviously, as we look forward towards the next generation of biofuels, renewable diesel is come into that picture. But a lot of those renewable diesel plants can also do sustainable aviation fuel. When you talk about the feedstocks that are really viable today for SAF, we're looking at the HEFA process. So our soybean crushers, we've seen a significant expansion within the soy crush space. And as well as, you know, we've got the livestock partners in there too. So, you know, a lot of distaste is sometimes for tallow, but we've got a lot of tallow that we're using, some joint ventures here with U.S. companies that we are partnering with who also have those JVs with Brazil to help bring the tallow in here. So it's a big interest to ours. You know, obviously with commodity prices where they are, everybody's hoping for that SAF to provide that new demand boost. We got a lot of things that have got to come together to really see that industry take off.
When CoBank enters a space like this, is it all through financing?
You know, and I will say my role on the knowledge exchange team at CoBank is to just help research, to help provide some of that insight of where the market is today, where it could go, and what we need to think about as we move forward. And again, the feedstocks, right? I mean, we're not necessarily right now funding any SAF plants, but we're there to come alongside those customers as they're looking at expansion, looking at maybe new opportunities to be in that space.
When you're looking at that space, of course, you talked about tallow. However, corn, soybeans, both would be capable. Which is the primary that you think the airline industry would be most interested in?
Well, today, really, the production cost of producing a HEFA-based a sustainable aviation fuel is much less than the alcohol to jet. And that's really why we're seeing all the SAF that is produced today with the HEFA process. You know, there's some pilot plants for alcohol to jet, but again, it's going to take time. You look back at the ethanol industry, though, it took time for us to improve those efficiencies, improve the over the history of ethanol. It was not economical at the start, but those efficiencies is improved. You know, hopefully we'll get that way with alcohol to jet because we do have a lot of corn that needs to be used. So, but again, that's a longer term outlook. We got to get some of these markets maybe established with the HEFA process today, get those introduced into the airline space, using those lower prices, keeping airlines competitive too, because it does cost more for them today.
So let me make sure I understand this, the difference in those two processes between FAME, I'm guessing, and the HEFA process within the soybean oil or vegetable oil industries?
Okay, so the HEFA process uses same feedstocks as FAME. Alcohol to jet is a totally different process, and they have a total different cost structure. And how you process that down to make your final fuel is what's different, and the cost is quite a bit different without getting too far into the weeds.
Yeah, so just for clarification, the alcohol to jet fuel process is an ethanol process, and the other is a biofuels process. Primarily, we would think about soybeans. FAME is the normal process under which we have produced soy diesel for decades. And then the HEFA process is the process that would be for sustainable aviation fuel. Is it also for renewable diesel?
Yes. And so that HEFA process can toggle back and forth between renewable diesel and SAF. You're seeing more renewable diesel facilities come online that actually could have half of their capacity renewable diesel, half of it SAF. And also, too, as the market drives that, they could actually go more towards one than the other. So say California market needs more renewable diesel, they could produce more renewable diesel. If you start to establish SAF more cost competitive, you have states who come in like Illinois, who does have a SAF bonus per se, right, with their tax structure, you could see more of those plants shifting towards SAF. Again, that all of those pieces coming together to push maybe more production into SAF.
The Phillips 66 Rodeo plant in California is, I think, the largest one now in the United States, maybe on the planet. How important is it to have it in place as a driver for sustainable aviation fuel or renewable diesel for that matter?
You know, I think just overall, as going back to the 3 billion gallon goal that the Biden administration had, 3 billion gallons is about 10% of our current use of aviation fuel. We're at 52 million gallons was our first half of 2024. That's a drop in the bucket, right? So we need these bigger plants. We need something bigger than the pilot sales. And so you talked about Phillips 66 Rodeo is a bigger one, right? You got to have more market penetration. And that's where you're going to start to see that when you see these bigger facilities come online.
When you look forward with the change of administration, how do you see this playing out? What role do states play, for instance, California, as opposed to the federal government?
You know, California's got their low carbon fuel standard, which is actually a huge reason why we're seeing more renewable diesel than SAF, because of the fact that it's more profitable to make renewable diesel. Now, they have a 20% cap coming on veg oils that will limit corn and soy oils use in their renewable diesel. But they don't have that cap on SAF. Maybe that pushes a little bit more into SAF in California state, right? Overall, you know, the federal, we're waiting for 45Z, which is a tax credit that's supposed to go into effect January 1. With this new Trump administration, do we see that paused? Probably. How long? We'll wait and see. But there is a little more unknowns on the federal level. So, you know, we might see some states step in. Airlines still have overall goals they're trying to meet. And so, again, market mandates, market decisions versus government mandates, we're going to have to see which one is the greater driver.
The airlines is actually a market decision based on what they believe the whole of the planet thinks about traveling by air and what those airline travelers want from the airlines.
And you're starting to see some airlines who are actually asking if their customers are willing to pay for their emissions. You're starting to see that at the end of your receipts, if you're looking at that. Some are paying for that. I guess, you know, I've heard numbers between 8 and 12% of customers today are making a decision of, hey, I'm willing to pay a higher price. Now, are you willing to pay all of that higher price? Maybe not, but maybe fractions of that. You know, airlines do have their own microscope on them from folks around the world. We may be stepping out of the Paris Climate Accord as the country of the United States, but these same airline companies operate in all these other countries. You look at the EU, they have a 2% mandate. So any of our airlines who are based here that also operate in the EU, they're going to be having to abide by those EU rules. We may start making SAF and shipping it over to the EU to help them meet their mandate as well.
When you look across the regions in the U.S., where do you expect SAF facilities to be located? Usually they're co-located with a refiner, that would put them on the Gulf Coast, probably on the West Coast, unlike the ethanol industry, which built out right where the corn was supplied.
You know, really got to be close to those major airports, right? A big cost of SAF is getting the SAF from the facility just to the airport, right? You know, we look at Chicago Midway's got a partnership there to work with the airline, Southwest Airlines. You got to get it close to that. But in Minnesota, there's camelina producers who are producing a crop, sending it to Montana. Montana Renewables is processing it, and then they're sending it back to Minneapolis and Detroit. Somehow that doesn't seem quite sustainable. So we really probably got to get some of these facilities, refineries close to those airports that are going to use the most of it.
Which brings me back to ethanol. The plants are already located. If you say Chicago, you have the ethanol plant located nearby. I believe there's already a pipeline as well, which is the most efficient way to move this product. Why soybean or vegetable oils rather than alcohol to jet?
It goes back to cost. The alcohol to jet cost, plant producing that final SAF, the costs are just a lot higher. And in our mind, we think it just doesn't make sense. But the cost, how to process that down, how to process the corn kernel down to what is usable and sustainable aviation fuel is a lot different than what is being used. If you think about it too, soybeans aren't the ones that are being processed into your SAF. You got to get a soybean oil that's then processed into it. So those plants have an oil that's already coming in, something that's a little more processed than like your corn kernel that would arrive.
in your crystal ball, when you think about this and the location of those plants near primary hubs, that would put them in Atlanta and Minneapolis and O'Hare for Chicago, New York, likely, LAX. Do you see farmers in those areas or other people building out SAF plants? I don't know whether I want to call them refineries, but an SAF plant, much like they built out the ethanol industry in the late 2000s?
I mean, look at where the Georgia LanzaJet plant is, right? I mean, that's our first real alcohol-to-jet one. I mean, the other one that we are pretty far along on is the Gevo one in South Dakota. You know, LanzaJet's making that choice. Things that are coming in are able to come in off the Gulf, too. You might be able to import in things. But in our minds, we want to see rural America thrive, right? So how do we make sure that this is beneficial to all? I think we're going to have to wait and see. I don't know if my crystal ball is clear enough to show me that.
Well, I think my what I was asking was whether your crystal ball was telling you that they were going to have to build a vegetable oil plant for SAF as opposed to a alcohol to jet for SAF.
So the challenge, we do become feedstock constrained with the HEFA process. We have much more potential to make a lot of SAF with our corn versus making a lot of SAF with, say, soybean oil. And so you're more feedstock constrained, which is, again, hopefully we can get that alcohol to jet cost down so that it can be another really big opportunity like the ethanol industry was to really take that to the next level of the production capacity to produce SAF.
Jackie Fatka is the lead economist for farm supply and biofuels at CoBank. It's an agricultural facing lending institution. She wrote an article in October titled Charting the Path Forward for SAF. To the key takeaways, as she sees them, are that SAF needs additional government and market incentives to encourage expansion, and that these incentives must be great enough, in the case of soybean, to turn refineries away from producing renewable diesel and to the much larger potential sustainable aviation fuel market. The incentives, by the way, are what University of Illinois agricultural economist Scott Irwin refers to as the policy stack. Essentially subsidies, regulations, which encourage the use of sustainable fuels as defined by governments. I'll moderate a pair of webinars Scott will present on the subject Thursdays, December the 4th and 11th. You may find the details of these in the calendar at willag.org or under the webinars events tab on the Farm Doc Daily website. Let's stay with energy policy and biofuels for a moment, but we'll switch to logistics. Fuel, as a liquid, is relatively easy to transport. However, when using a feedstock like soybean to make renewable diesel or sustainable aviation fuel, the other product in the stream is protein. We give you the price of those two products here on Illinois Public Media most days when reporting from the CME Group, soybean oil and soybean meal futures. The oil pressed from the soybean is made into cooking oil and fuel and a whole bunch of other things. The solid part left over contains protein, and it's called soybean meal. Now, it's usually fed to animals. The push for more fuel to be made from soybean is causing more soybean meal to come onto the marketplace. It needs to be shipped further, and that, as you'll hear in a bit, is a logistical issue the National Grain and Feed Association has been considering. I spoke with its president and CEO, Mike Seifert. He'll first tell us what the NGFA does and who it represents. It's grain elevators, but here's how he tells it.
Three key things we really do. We advocate for the industry, a lot of advocacy in Washington. We do a number of safety programs for the industry. And then we also, we've been an association for 128 years, and for about 123, 24 of that, we have run a arbitration program and trade rules. So kind of really kind of the rules of trade governing the industry as well. And those are kind of the three primary things we do for our membership, along with a lot of educational opportunities and conferences.
Logistical areas are in your specialties?
Yeah, absolutely. We spend a lot of time working on transportation issues, whether it's rail, whether it's water, whether it's highways. Obviously, huge importance for our members being able to move that product. And so that is I would kind of say when it comes to policy and advocacy work, if you ask the majority of our members, they would probably tell you that's one of the most important things we do for them on policy, and that that's kind of our bread and butter.
So how do you advocate in that? Is it talking about advocating for the lock and dam systems? Is it advocating for roads and bridges? Is it advocating for rail spurs? What sorts of things?
Yes.
I thought so.
So we will do a lot of work, obviously, working with Capitol Hill. One of the things that we're working on right now is the Water Resources Development Act reauthorization. Locks and dams, particularly on the Mississippi system, the Illinois River, the Ohio River. A lot of focus, a lot of time on that, both for the upgrades that we need. A lot of those locks and dams, had an original 50-year life was what they were targeted for. They were built in the 1930s. We're getting close to the 2030s. So on that. Also, we'll put a lot of focus on the river dredging and the channels and making sure, particularly on the lower Mississippi, that we can continue to move those facilities. On the rail side, a lot of work with the Hill, a lot of work with the Surface Transportation Board in terms of oversight, regulation, other railroads. And then we do, all the Class 1s are our member companies, but we also do a lot of work with the Class 1s and our membership to really kind of try and make sure we're working with them in a way that can keep these products moving. And then obviously, highway infrastructure is important as well, whether it's the highway infrastructure or hours of service regulations, weight limits on trucks. Those are areas that we put a lot of focus on as well.
So when you're talking to the Class 1 railways, and this is the question I really want to answer, and I'm running out of time, but I'd like you to, I don't know whether you've been doing work on this or not, as the development of renewable diesel and SAF have come into play, it's fairly easy to move bean oil, not so easy to move bean meal. It appears that will need to be railed somewhere else. And I don't think there are facilities and cars enough to manage that as we build out those facilities. What kind of logistical issues have you been working on, if at all, in this area?
Well, I think certainly one of the things is folks trying to determine exactly how much of that crush is going to come on. But there have been discussions that may change the rail traffic. It may change the movement. You may be doing more domestic movements on the initial front than you are export, but you're probably going to have to export some of that soy meal that you haven't done previously. And so I know that is something certainly those carriers that are in the regions where a lot of this crush is at or proposed to take place are taking a look at. You're also seeing some of our member companies that are in the export business are now building or upgrading facilities to kind of be focused more on specifically that soy meal or to have a better capability to handle it. And so you're definitely, you're seeing those changes begin to take place in the transportation system and certainly that preparation beginning to take place for those adjustments.
So not many worries at this point about that part of the industry. You think the build out will happen?
I think from a transportation standpoint, I think those adjustments will happen. I think there's still some questions. Obviously, you've had some drops in pricing. You've had, for some folks, the UCO issue, but I think there's a lot of discussion, too. I think how much of that will come on. You've had capital investment costs, but obviously interest rates are coming down, so will that help bring some of it on? And I know there's some folks also watching. There's been a lot of talk of tariffs under the new administration, but, I've actually talked to some who have said that might actually lead to some of this expansion, depending on what happens on the UCO side. So it's interesting how something that may be a heartburn issue for one sector of ag may not be for the others, or you push one, it's kind of like whack-a-mole. You do push one thing here and something else pops up over there. And so I think that's one of the, I think there's going to be a lot of work trying to figure that out probably over the next year or so would be my guess.
UCO is shorthand for used cooking oil. You've likely heard the grain analyst here on Will Ag discussing the import of used cooking oil into the United States over the past few months. It comes from China and some other countries into California, where it's being processed into renewable diesel. There are two reasons this has been the case. First, it costs less than U.S. harvested soybean oil, or has. That might be changing as China adjusts its export policies. And secondly, its carbon footprint is better than soybean. It's used, so the UCO, or used cooking oil, carbon footprint does not pick up until it's been thrown away at the restaurant or wherever it might be first sourced. Soybean oil's carbon footprint runs its whole supply chain. So used cooking oil looks more sustainable because it's being reused, and the first use isn't counted in the carbon footprint. Mike Seifert, whom you just heard, is the president and CEO of the National Grain and Feed Association. I spoke with him during the National Association of Farm Broadcasting Convention in Kansas City last week. Finally today, it was 161 years ago today, the 19th day of November, that President Abraham Lincoln delivered the Gettysburg Address. The Civil War had entered its third year, and for 3 days, more than 90,000 soldiers from the Army of the Potomac and about 75,000 troops from the Army of Northern Virginia had fought at a crossroads in Pennsylvania's fruit-growing hill country. The clash between the Union and Confederate soldiers in the market town of Gettysburg stands as the largest land battle ever fought in the Western Hemisphere. On this day in history, President Abraham Lincoln came to the site to consecrate a cemetery in their honor. The brief Gettysburg Address marked a defining moment in the Civil War. 67 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we're engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation, or any nation so conceived and so dedicated, can long endure. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives, that that nation might live. It's altogether fitting and proper that we should do this. But in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here, have consecrated it far above our power to add or detract. The world will little note nor long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here. It is for us, the living, rather, to be dedicated here to the unfinished work which they who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced. It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion, that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. The Gettysburg Address was delivered by Abraham Lincoln, November the 19th of 1863. You've been listening to the Closing Market Report. I'm Todd Gleason.